This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
As was mentioned, I am an ordained Southern Baptist preacher. And what's interesting is how I became a Southern Baptist was for very deep theological reasons. The young girl I wanted to go out with would only go out with me if I went to church with her on Sunday. And she happened to go to a Southern Baptist church, so that's why I became one. If she would have been an Episcopalian, that would have been a part of your denomination, but, you know, so is life. Last night, I'm not going to go over what we talked about last night, but we did talk a little bit about the history as to why we have an immigration problem. If you remember, I kind of said that we have this problem, which started in the 1830s, and that basically when one nation builds roads into another nation to steal its resources and its cheap labor, we should never be surprised that those people take those same roads following everything that has been stolen from them. So the reason I'm in this country is I'm following everything that has been stolen from me coming from Cuba, specifically the rum, the tobacco, and the sugar, the three necessities of life. We also saw a clip of a documentary I made, Trails of Hope and Terror, same title as the book I wrote. It really got into a lot of the history of Latin America, and at least the 10-minute clip that we saw in the beginning. It goes on to go into other things. We ended last night by me saying that it's hopeless, that there is no hope, and then what do you do in the midst of hopelessness? What is the praxis that is involved when you know you're not going to win? And then I concluded by saying that we fight for justice, not because we're going to win, because we're not. We fight for justice because it is a testament of not only the faith we claim to have, but also, more importantly, it's the humanity we claim to share in. So that's a 1-2-minute recap of last night. And then today what I want to do is move a little bit more into the question, not so much why they come, which was last night's discussion, but now that we're here, what do you do with us? We call them illegal, so that we could throw them in jail. And I have to say this, illegal is a racist term as far as I know, because no human being is illegal. We are undocumented, or I was undocumented. What that means is, if you, on the way to church, forgot your wallet, and you get pulled over by the police officer, you're not an illegal driver. You're undocumented. You don't have the proper documentations. And in most nations of the world, that's not a big deal. You know, you just have to get properly documented. But by using the term illegal, and by the way, the liberal press, the New York Times, which I read every day, also uses this term illegal. By using the term illegal, what it does is that it criminalizes an entire group of people whose only crime is that they don't have proper documentation. So, when we criminalize a people, then we can say from the highest office of the land that they're rapists and they're criminals and they bring drugs and they have a lot of problems. We justify the construction of the undocumented as something dangerous so that we could then pass laws and regulations that are a violation of human rights so that we can feel safe. And besides that, it gets a lot of people elected by creating that fear factor. The whole theme of me being here is let us see Jesus. We want to see Jesus. So I could tell you that Jesus in the flesh is Juana Villegas. Juana Villegas was pulled over in a traffic violation, and she was undocumented. She was pregnant and was going into labor. So they took her to Nashville General Hospital in Tennessee, and while giving birth, they went ahead and chained her, cuffed her to her bed. Now, I have no idea the pain of giving birth, but I would imagine being cuffed to a bed while giving birth adds to the trauma and the pain of the situation. While giving birth, the shepherd was standing guard over her. Her husband was barred from entering the room to be with her during the giving of the birth. And as soon as the baby was born, it was separated from the mother. She was sent back to jail without a breast pump, which I would imagine, again, I have no idea, but I would imagine it's a painful, painful situation. Her crime, like I said, was driving without a license. Every Latino is guilty of being undocumented unless they could prove otherwise. That's a scary situation for me to be in as a Latino. I constantly have to prove that I am a citizen, because if I don't, I would automatically also be illegal, and all kinds of procedures could fall upon me. As I mentioned yesterday, whenever I speak at a town, I'm always afraid to go out at night. The violence against Latinos and Latinas in this country has skyrocketed with all of the rhetoric of us being dangerous criminals. And as a person who occupies a Latino body, that scares me. I just don't go out at night when I'm visiting towns. When I left last night, I ran to my hotel room because I just don't know where I'm at. I worked with an organization on the border of in Nogales in Arizona called No More Death. And we did research on what immigrants face when they are under custody. A publication came out of it called Crossing the Line, Human Rights Abuses of Migrants in Short-Term Custody on Arizona-Sonora Border. It was published by No More Death. And I heard the testimonies of people who were detained by the Border Patrol on the Mexican side of the border. I saw the bruises on their faces. I mean, it's not like this is hearsay. I actually interviewed them and interviewed some of them in the documentary that you, some of you saw last night, and saw some of those individuals. Let me just share some of the stories that Jesus, in flesh as an undocumented immigrant, experienced at the hands of our Border Patrol. And by the way, these stories occurred not under the Trump administration, but under the administration of a Democrat. Which is why I say, it doesn't matter if you're a conservative Republican or a liberal Democrat, the policies towards the undocumented are pretty much the same. It's just which one is less damning in the rhetoric. Three women and two children, aged 14 and 16, after being apprehended in the desert, were forced to run for 30 minutes back and forth while crossing the desert. While being kicked, while being pushed into cacti, and while hearing derogatory remarks. This is what we call among ethicists institutional violence. That is when the structures are designed to inflict violence in our name. It's not like the violence of just hitting somebody. It's the violence of the structures themselves that are set up to maintain these type of violence. There's a 21-year-old woman who was forced to remove her top and lie on the cell floor. Again, an institutional violence with a sexual abuse component to it. A 17-year-old girl was searched by male guards, improperly touching her while searching her. Again, an example of this institutional violence. We collected about 345 testimonies. Is it any wonder that Amnesty International has said that our border policy makes the United States a violation of human rights? The film documents some of this, but we have actually documented this. In the film, okay, one of the things we do with No More Deaths is that we put water out in the migrant trails. So we would walk the migrant trails where we believe migrants are going to be walking, and we leave water, food, and medicine. We have on film one of the Border Patrol agents kicking over the water bottles and pouring the water on the floor. Regardless of how you feel about the undocumented, not providing water to the thirsty is as sadistic as one can get. And the interesting is, while the God in the film is pouring the water on the floor, he's looking at the camera saying, "You don't scare me. I'm just, you know, did you put the water here? You don't scare me by filming me." It reminds me of those postcards from the South where they were lynching people and everyone is standing before the lynched person smiling into the camera. Because what it says is, I'm not afraid of any authority and I'm not afraid of being judged for my moral actions. We have created a culture of cruelty in where doing these acts publicly is nothing to be ashamed of. Many human rights organizations, legal scholars, the United Nations meticulously have documented these human rights violations. It's not just our group. Independent organizations, worldwide organizations has also done this. There was one individual held by ICE detention in San Pedro, California, who was denied medication. His sister came when she heard that he was being held with the medication, but they refused to provide that medication. He ended up dying. We should not be surprised when Edimal Alvarez Arroyo, while at ICE detention in Rhode Island, was also refused medication for his epileptic seizures. He also died. These are just two examples of many examples. And the reason these things happen is because they're undocumented, they have no rights as citizens. Therefore, there's no watchdog over them, or the prison industry. And to make things worse, once they're deported, they have no avenues by bringing a complaint. When I'm in Nogales, the other thing that we find is that when an undocumented immigrant is detained, they take away all their possessions, specifically their money. And in return, the government gives them a check for the money they took. Now, if they don't have documentation and they took away their license and all this stuff, and they're now in Mexico, how do you cash an out-of-country check in Mexico? One of our volunteers collects all these checks, crosses the border, cashes them at the bank, and then brings the money back to them. At least, we try to help them. But how many people, if they don't come to the center where we provide food for them, there's no way of them knowing that we can help in that way. So I mentioned last night that the reason we cannot fix this immigration problem, the immigration border is broken. I think everyone agrees, it is broken. But by being broken, we're making too much money. Certain corporations are making too much money. So it has to remain broken so that our stock portfolios can increase, because more than likely, a lot of us may actually have stock in some of these corporations. So since 2011, nearly half of the beds in the nation's civil detention system were privately owned and was privately owned by two corporations, specifically Cork Civic, which last year posted $491.6 million in profits, and GEO Corporation, which last year posted $603.1 million in profits. Now, what's interesting, if you look at CoreCivic, back in the year 2000, when they were called the Correction Corporation of America, they were going bankrupt. They were in the verge of bankruptcy. But by signing contracts to house the undocumented, they've become a multi-billion dollar industry. Here's how. When you are detained, it, according to the ICE 2024 budget, these private corporations charge $150 a night to detain you in a cell. That's more than what the church paid for me to stay across the street at the Omni Hotel for one night. It would be cheaper to house the undocumented at the Omni Hotel than to house them with these private corporations. One undocumented immigrant I spoke to said that every day a doctor would come and do a physical checkup on him. And I was thinking, well, that's nice of our government. No, I forgot that the corporation then bills the government for daily medical treatment of this individual. So there's a lot of fat in that budget. We saw these flights now on military planes heading down to the border, to Colombia to drop off the undocumented. That flight cost $250,000 in your tax bill. We could probably fly everyone first class on commercial airlines, and it will be cheaper than using a government plane to send the undocumented back. To deport 1 million undocumented people in 1 year, remember, we have like 20 million at least, but just 1 million, will end up costing the U.S. government $88 billion for that 1 year. It will reduce the domestic product by $1.7 trillion, according to the American Immigration Council. Now, we all pay that in taxes, but the corporations responsible for the detainment and the extraction of the undocumented are going to make a bundle. Not surprisingly, both CoreCivic and GEO Group have an unbelievably high lobbyist budget and have literally written a lot of the laws in states like Georgia and Mississippi and mostly red states, probably Texas, I don't know. But in order to make sure that when you are detained, you first go to jail before you're sent and deported back. And the average person, the average detention at one of these facilities is approximately 46 days at $150 a night. This is why I'm hopeless. Because if we were to shut this down, these two corporations will go bankrupt. If they go bankrupt, if your stock portfolio has stock in these companies, your retirement funds will drop. And if that happens, a lot of people will be unemployed who work for these companies. So it is important that the immigration crisis is not fixed, regardless of all the rhetoric. Yeah, build the wall. The construction cost to build that wall is making a lot of money for a very few amount of people. And it's interesting, the people who are building our wall are the same people who built the separation wall in Palestine. I have a book coming out. There's four, and we're a Palestinian colleague and myself write a book about wars around the world and how they use to reinforce colonial settler colonialism and keep people out or keep people in. In 2019, the U.S. network investigation found that during 2019, there were 400 allegations of sexual assault or abuse, inadequate medical care, 800 instances of physical force employed against the inmates, 29 fatalities, of which 7 were suicide, and nearly 200,000 filed grievances. This is a human rights crisis that we really don't know about because as undocumented, they are invisible. Amnesty International has documented how these inmates are routinely denied food, water, medical attention, while being exposed to verbal, physical, and psychological abuse. One of the things that they do is that when you are picked up, and we've documented this, they have these like pickup trucks that have like a dog kennel in the back, and they put the migrant in that, and then they turn on the heat. While in the desert, or they drive recklessly when there's no seatbelts back there, which is also what happened in Baltimore that began that riot when it was done to an African American. So when we are allowed to abuse a particular group of people, that gives us permission to abuse all people. And it's only a matter of time that this abuse goes beyond just people of color, because it becomes part of this culture of cruelty. If the detention numbers were to decrease, as I mentioned, stock values would drop. In our neo-capitalist structure, we have to keep those beds full. And in fact, I take that back, we really don't, because the way the government contract is set up is that we pay for the beds whether they are full or not. So it doesn't matter if the beds are empty, we're paying for all those beds. There's no substantive legislation or regulatory standards governing the detention conditions, and the Department of Homeland Security internal standards are poorly enforced and often and not even binding, according to the UCLA Law Review. When the most vulnerable are at the mercy of profit-seeking corporation, we all really need to be afraid. And that's where we find ourselves now. And like I said, I am afraid. I'm afraid of being harassed, beaten by some zealot Trumpite who believed that all us Latinos are illegal until proven otherwise. And I say this as one who has received several death threats. And I don't know, this thing called Professor Watchlist, which is the most dangerous professors in the country. I have the honor of being on that because of speaking out against not only this injustice, but many others. We're living in a very different time in where academic freedom is rapidly being silenced at our universities and our college, in where the truth of history, like we discussed last night, becomes the means by which to defund schools. And here's what I'm really, really afraid of, speaking personally. I am a naturalized citizen. I wasn't born in this country. And what the government giveth, the government taketh away. Now, this is not a hyperbole because we've already done this operation Wetback in the 1950s, where people, Mexicans born in the United States, were deported to Mexico, even though they were born here and their families lived here for generations. I could just imagine some kind of legislation that immigrants, natural citizens who are, who are unloyal to America should be all sent back. And I say that because we're already having an executive order was just signed that individuals born in this country whose parents happen to be from another country should not be declared as citizens. So once we start playing with who's a citizen and who's not, I am really concerned. I mean, my wife and I already have contingency plans designed in case something was to happen. This is the kind of country we're living in now. I was a refugee once, and I'm thinking in my older age, I'm going to be a refugee again. It's a scary time to occupy the body of a Latino today. So, I, like I said, remain hopeless. This immigration problem has been occurring since the 1830s, when the borders of the United States crossed into Mexico, and the people who lived on those lands all of a sudden found themselves in the United States. So this is something that's been going on now for, what, two centuries? It's not going to be fixed just because we think we want to get it fixed and we think it's immoral. Especially under this particular government. And that's not to just say that, you know, Republicans are all bad and this is horrible and the Democrats are better. Let's not forget that Barack Obama was called within the community the deporter-in-chief because he deported more undocumented immigrants than all the presidents together up to that point. So I'm afraid of both parties and the leadership of both parties. And even if comprehensive reform was to occur, and we're nowhere close to moving in that direction, quite the contrary, but let's just suspend reality and believe that might happen, people will still be dying in our deserts. I live in the Saturday between the crucifixion of Friday and the resurrection of Sunday. My people live in the Saturday, where all we know is the horror and the gore of the crucifixion. And any promise of a resurrection sounds utopian at this point. I don't know if there's going to be a Sunday. All I know is the brutality of Friday. And as I mentioned last night, to go to the undocumented sitting in the shadow of Saturday and tell them, have hope, it's all going to work out. All things work for good for those who are called according to God's purposes, sounds trite, if not insulting. I'm always amazed by Job's three friends who came to him and just sat with him. And when they opened their mouth, that's when God got angry, because they began to explain that which cannot be explained, and that is the suffering of a righteous person. In the same way, I cannot explain the horrors, and I just touched on a few of them, that the undocumented are facing. Instead, if we want to see the face of Jesus, we need to sit in the dust with the Jobs of the undocumented. I'm not preaching hopelessness that leads to inactivity. That's a middle class privilege. It's hopeless, nothing I can do about it. Let me watch Oprah instead. When you are living in the shadows, when you are among the marginalized, you have no choice but to continue to fight for a better life and for justice. My parents living in the slums of New York had to fight. They did not have the luxury of the hopelessness of the situation of doing nothing. So those of us who practice what we've been calling this liberation theology believe strongly in the solidarity with the oppressed, which means sitting with them in the dust and sharing in that burden. I preach hopelessness as a way of propelling us towards action, like I mentioned last night. When we realize we have nothing to lose, that's when we become the most dangerous and the most radical. And as an ethicist, I'm trying to get people to that point. It's easy to be a Christian when you think you're going to win, a lot harder when you know you're going to fail and be defeated. So, I mentioned yesterday, don't talk about the virtue of hospitality with me, because hospitality assumes you own the house. The natural resources you stole from my country and the cheap labor that built this empire means that we're the ones that built the house, and I want my house back. Instead of hospitality, we should be talking about restitution. What do we owe the descendants of these the descendants of immigrants, of people in Latin America, for the gunboat diplomacy that was our policy for the last 100 years and seems to become our new policy with this new administration that mentioned manifest destiny at least 3 times during the inaugural address? I don't want hospitality. We need to talk about restitution. What is owed to Latin America for invading those countries along the Gulf of Mexico 26 times, and for maintaining CIA operations to overthrow those governments 21 times. That's 47 times during the 20th century. Once every other year, we engage in regime change. What do we owe these undocumented immigrants? I'll end there.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.